There's just something about pedaling a bike across the state, or maybe across the country. From SDPB, today is Monday, February 24th. This is In the Moment. Coming up this hour, bike journeys and pilgrimages and community building. We will start with the maker of the documentary Bike Vessel. Eric Seals and his father rode from St. Louis to Chicago together and filmed the journey. It's the story of a father who survived 3 open-heart surgeries and is pedaling to save his own life and set a new example for his family. We revisit the Oahe Wheelmen in the center of the state as they carve a new path to ride by the river, plus a pastor and a pilgrim on a 4,000-mile search for belonging. Brian Heron, the pedal pilgrim, is later in the hour. We're broadcasting today from SDPB's Kirby Family Studio in Sioux Falls. I'm Lori Walsh. You're in the moment. News is first. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. This hour, we will be diving into journeys, pilgrimages even, taken on 2 wheels. We are starting with Eric Seals, director of the film Bike Vessel. The documentary is part of the PBS Independent Lens series. It's the intimate story of a 350-mile bike ride Seals took with his father that explored cycling, connection, and Black health. If you're West River, SDPB is screening Bike Vessel on February 27th in Rapid City and March 5th in Spearfish. It premieres on SDPB TV tonight. Filmmaker Eric Seals happened to be filming his father play tennis one day. Donnie Seals Sr. had been a strong tennis player in his day, but open-heart surgeries and a lifetime of stress and poor eating habits had taken a toll on his physical abilities. When Eric's dad saw the footage, he decided to make an immediate change. And Eric decided to come along behind the camera and on the back of his bicycle.
Yeah, I was just doing home videos. I was doing nothing more than recording it so we could have proof of who actually won. It wasn't like this grand scheme of a documentary that was going to take me years. I was just, you know, sharing content with him. And when he saw the footage, he was like, wow. You know, you have those times where you just haven't looked at yourself in a while, and he hadn't. And it automatically sparked something in him. And so it's interesting because that ends up being a theme throughout the production and the creation of this project. You never know what spark could open the door for someone or support them to continue on their journey. And so he got a bike. When I tell you the next day, it was the next day. And he called me because we talk almost every day. I said, that sounds like a horrible idea. I don't know what you're thinking. You haven't ridden in years. You can barely walk to a certain degree. He's like, I got to do something. And so, you know, at that point, I was just continuing to record home videos of what he was doing. And it wasn't until I started to share with more people my dad's history and his story that more people became interested. And I said, let me just keep following him to see what happens.
Yeah. 3 heart surgeries. The insurance company is pretty much betting on him to not make it very long. Yep. There's not a lot of hope for the future, and yet he gets this bike and starts riding it. You weave throughout this documentary of his journey and the trip you're going to take together with home movies of your own family from pretty far back, which is just fantastic. So I want to ask you about that. And then a little bit of, you know, cultural and American history as well. But how long have you been behind the camera, and has this, you know, process of documenting things been part of your family tradition?
I can't tell you a time where I didn't have a camera in front of my face. I got it from my father. And it's to no surprise that I became a filmmaker watching him with home videos and stuff like that. He got a degree in radio and television, didn't get to pursue his career like he wanted to, but it definitely got transferred to me. And so, you know, before I was born and for my brother and sister and always growing up, I just always had a camera in front of me. And then eventually it transferred to me recording and being behind the camera. And I didn't realize how important that was going to be to the story. You know, I really wanted people when watching this to see that this is a hardworking family from the Midwest that, you know, is a 2-income household and that health can hit anybody, You know, it's not just how much money you make, it's also cultural, it's also your background. The way that we ate is going to be motivated by the way that my grandparents ate and the way that their grandparents ate. And so when I look at this film and I look at people who want to change their life when looking at health, I think it's important that we look at our history so we can see how we got here today. Everybody has a different background, everybody has a different history. I can tell you there's definitely a connection in everybody's family that we're all eating something that we shouldn't be, or we all have some bad habits, and some of them are connected by, you know, traditions. And traditions are great, they're beautiful. But let's also look at the root of how we got to where we are at this point.
Yeah. I'm curious to know the moment in your mind where it switches from whether with the story with your dad or just in general, you know, collecting home movies, lots of people do that. Not a lot of people figure out the power of storytelling. When does it become a story? When does it become a narrative for you?
I run a video production film company. We do a lot of corporate work. We've done events, we've done you know, short documentaries, corporate projects, and it got to a point where I was asking myself, why am I what am I what's my purpose? Why am I here? And I think that's something that we all ask ourselves from time to time. And as I started to do some more research, I really landed on the fact that I love history and I love film. And so to me, that's documentaries. And I had to ask myself, what is something that I want to put out in the world? You know, working on corporate projects to make a billionaire company make another billion is, yeah, that doesn't do anything for me. That pays the bills, but I needed something that fulfilled my soul. And as I was looking around, I said, what story is around me that can make an impact in my community? And I'm like, little did I know, it's already here. I'm already working on it. And I didn't know it at the time. And so that's when it switched for me. And I went from making home videos with my family, made a little 5-minute video that I shared with everybody to I'm gonna really expand this into a full story. I hope my dad wants to do it because I'm gonna convince him if he doesn't want to.
You could have just followed him along in a chase car. Instead, you get on a bike with him for a journey from St. Louis to Chicago in 350 miles in 4 days, which is pretty ambitious for a 68-year-old man who's had three surgeries, and maybe even ambitious for you as a younger man trying to figure out how to make this happen logistically, emotionally, and physically. Why go on the ride with him?
I was filming him during this time, seeing this man change his life in his late 60s. I'm like, what the heck am I doing? I'm gonna fall along the same path that he went. I'm less than five. Well, I was more than 5 years at the time, but I'm very close to his age of when he had his first open heart surgery. I think he had it at 43. I'm like, I'm not that, I'm less than a decade away from that, and I'm not doing anything. Former athlete, just not doing it like I used to. And so I'm like, this guy has definitely motivated me. I'm already close to my dad, and so I'm like, let me buy a bike, and I'm gonna start riding with him, and we start riding every weekend. And it was a great way to bond. You know, we're not thinking of it like, let's ride this weekend to bond. It's like, yeah, let's hang out. I mean, I genuinely love and like my father, and as I'm adult now, we can hang out in a different way. And we got to a point where we needed to celebrate his 5 years of, you know, riding the bike. I said, dude, we gotta do something. And so I said, let's ride from Minnesota or Minneapolis, let's ride the length of the Mississippi, let's ride from Detroit. And everything got knocked down. But when I said, let's do St. Louis to Chicago, he said, huh. And when he paused, I said, oh, I got him. We're in. I don't know. And this is the thing, I had no idea. I really had no idea how far it was. It was just, I was thinking about, you know, how long it took me to drive there. And so I had did no planning when I came up with the idea. I didn't do any logistical routes. I gave that all to him because he's like, okay, if I'm going to do this, then I need to be in charge of the planning, how we're going to get from A to B. I said, cool. As long as we start by the arch and end by the Sears Tower, I'm cool.
Tell me about your rather interesting relationship with tire pressure.
You know, that's a great question because I've learned while riding with my dad, we are different riders. At the beginning, it was me just hanging out with my dad, riding with him. But then I realized it was therapeutic for me to ride, and I love riding now. But my purpose to ride is a little bit different than his. He's very competitive. He's in the stats and numbers and, looking at his Garmin and figuring out how he can ride a little bit better next time. And while all those numbers are important to me, being in film and being behind a computer all day, I just appreciated being outside. I just appreciated riding. Every time I rode, it was a win. And so I didn't get into the minutia. And I would say filling up tires is not minutia, but I didn't get into all the details like he did. And so I'll go on a ride and not have all my spare parts because I'm just happy to be on the bike. The other part of that is I also knew I was riding with him. Now, this is the truth. It's bad, but the truth is, riding with him, I know he brings extra gear. And I'm like, well, if he brings extra gear, I don't need to worry about it. And my bike had recently got stolen, so I got a new bike. And so I didn't realize that all the gear that I originally packed on there was gone. And on top of it, last but not least, I was worried about the film crew. We had about 8 to 10 people with us. I was doing all the logistics with them, make sure that they had everything they need. I said something got forgotten, and it was all my gear to change tires. And he let me know that the entire rest of the ride.
Let's talk about your relationship because you also watch him doubt himself, doubt his ability to do it, and you push him in a way. He reminds you that you're not 18 anymore and you're going to start feeling your age someday. And you are bouncing off each other, challenging each other, joking with each other, but then also loving each other at the same time. Tell me about your relationship with your dad those 4 days.
Everything happens for a reason, and we don't know how our lives are gonna pan out. But with my dad having to go into forced early retirement or being fired, he had a lot more time at home. And so that's the time when I'm about to enter middle school and high school. And so while it sucked that he couldn't go fulfill his dreams and go work, we got a lot closer. I had breakfast with him every day before I went to school. I had him at every practice on every activity from baseball to track to football. I told him the other day, one time I told him I was interested in soapbox derby racing. He said, let's go to a meeting. So he was su supportive in a way that I wouldn't have had. Not that I wish for him to get sick, but we were just very close. And so what would happen is we had two different relationships. Relationship in particular during football season. A relationship during football, my dad's like, look, when you play football, you have to have a different attitude. You can talk to me a little bit different. We're gonna be not equals, but I get it. You're in that mode. Once you step outside of those lines, don't bring that home. That's a very Don't let your mom see it, all that type of stuff. And so I equate that to when we ride together, never disrespectful, but it reminds me of those days when I talked to my dad a little bit different, or he might hear me cuss. But as soon as we would get off the bike, he's like, I'm dad now. And so, we established just a really close relationship. And, even to this day, I'm talking to him 2 to 3 days out of the week. With my film production company, letting him know everything that's going on. And so he's been very supportive. And I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for, what he instilled in me in all those years.
Yeah. You mentioned him losing his job, and I think your sister says it in the film really clearly about being a black man at IBM in the 1980s and people putting pressure on you. And then when you rise to the occasion, there's more pressure and you're always right at that end. Do you think that the stress contributed to his health problems?
1,000%. The stress that he had to make it, hands down, was a contributing factor. Not all, contributing factor. And that's one of the blessings that I've definitely got from this film. I didn't realize how much the stress was getting to him. We talk about exercising, we talk about eating, but one of the doctors that we talked to said stress is like a death by 1,000 paper cuts. It's real slow, it's real small over time, but it adds up over time. And so, let alone being at IBM as a black man in the 80s, trying to level up your career and trying to get to the next level is already stressful. Then once you add the racial component to it, it's another, level of stress that's going to add to, what you're going through. And so it's allowed me to look at my current situation and say that I'm stressed out. You know, I think for those who are stressed out, we don't know it until it's too late or something happens. But it's something that is a silent killer. And it's important for us to recognize, because if you're eating great and you're exercising, that's very important. But let's not forget the daily stresses of our life.
And many of those stresses you cannot control.
100%. And so you can't control them. So you either have to manage them, you have to mitigate them, you have to make sure that, you know, I think about work, and obviously work is very important, but we put such a high level of importance on it that sometimes everything else drops. I think about when my company is doing its best, I gain the most weight because we're doing so much work. And so we sometimes look at rest as something that's earned. No, rest is something that's needed. And so, you know, looking at this documentary and what my dad was going through has definitely opened my eyes into where I'm at right now. It's not where I want to be. And this documentary has definitely helped me recognize that.
Yeah, and there's something here happening too about as you, throughout the film, go back in time and look at, this here's the first heart surgery. Here is our relationship with the medical professional. Here's the history of Black Americans' relationship with medical professionals. You can put, I think, your dad like just changing everything in, for himself, but also for his family and also for future generations of your family. But not just in his career.
And
He's
it
breaking those barriers as a coder or as a systems engineer, but really the real barriers he's breaking is at the dinner table, exercise, acknowledging that stress exists, the radical sense of rest. That's kind of mind-blowing.
And with little support. I mean, I'd say in the 90s, when, you know, I told you my friends would come over and we don't have burgers, we don't have steak in the house. We had skim milk. Oh, my grandmother thought we were just out there. What? You don't drink whole milk? What do you mean you don't want to eat this ham? I mean, my dad's first open heart surgery, I was about 8. And when I can't tell you a time from 8 to now, just turned 39. Can't tell you the time I remember him ever ordering any red meat. You know what I mean? The only time I've seen him eat red meat would be on accident, and he'd be pissed. He'd eat something like, "What's in this? I thought it was just, and it was accidentally in there." And so those are things that really motivated me about the story, because he was someone who decided to make a change in his life. He wasn't a doctor. He wasn't a nutritionist. He just said, you know, this is the research that I've done. I'm going to give up eating red meat. I'm going to give up eating late at night. He still has, you know, things that he's working on. He put some cheese in front of that man. That's a wrap. But the thing is, he's trying. And so I think about my family, my extended family. And that's one of the messages that I want to get out. Sometimes the hardest people that we have to convince are the loved ones next to us. So if you have that friend who's vegan, that friend who's pescatarian or vegetarian, don't make fun of them when they need to go to a restaurant that, you know, suits their needs. You'll support them. Those are the ones that hurt the most when we're making fun of the people who are trying to make a change.
Your mom says, I want something more than the food. I want him.
Yeah, that was dope.
What's your mom's role in all of this?
Man, she's a superhero. She's the glue. She is the positive energy inside of all of our life. Hardest working person, never saw her complain a day in my life. And now that I have my son who's 2 years old, and I come home tired, I can only imagine coming home to three kids after teaching third graders all day. Your son or your husband can no longer work. You know, money's not coming in how it used to. And I never saw her bat an eye of, you know, saying that, you know, feel sorry for me or anything like that. Just that generation of hard work, it showed through her. And so this is the beautiful thing about this film for me, and this is all internal selfish. I've never interviewed my mom about how she felt during that time. That's a win that I get that I didn't understand was going to come while interviewing my siblings and my parents. I learned a lot about my mom during that time, along with how hard it was for her. But she's like, I'm not going to show it to y'all.
What did you learn about yourself?
I learned that I am a replica of my father in ways that I like and ways that I don't like. And I think I've done this thing where I'm going to make that change later. And then the quote that I heard from my dad, stop saying tomorrow's not promised, today's not promised. And, you know, being an athlete and I mean, just working out 4 or 5 times a day, I just ate horribly. I didn't know I ate horribly until I stopped working out 4 or 5 times a day. And so what I learned about myself is, I'm not immune from any of the things that my dad went through unless I make a major change. And so it's definitely woken me up on what I need to do myself.
When you take the film around to festivals and events, and we're having a screening here in South Dakota, several screenings, I think, as
That's
part of
amazing.
Independent Lens, and people here will talk about their food stories and their, exercise journeys and such. What are you hearing from audiences that maybe even have surprised you, but or encouraged you?
I think the thing I'm hearing from audiences that I'm proud of is a lot of people have been making a change in their life, and this is that support to keep them going. Seeing somebody else who's done it at that age of 65, my sister said it when I was talking to her. She said, if he's making a life change at 65, what excuse do we have? Really don't have one. If you're above the ground, it's not too late. And so I think the most encouraging thing is that everybody who watches it can get something from it. I didn't want to make a movie that was beating people over the head on how they need to change their life because that doesn't do anything. The way we reach people is you got to allow that message to get to them. So when I talk to my expert interviews, my subjects, my doctors, don't talk over people's head. Don't use big words and big jargon that doesn't connect with them. I didn't want to tell the story in a way from a fear standpoint. Yeah, there's some scary things in it, but you know, there's another side of my dad's open heart surgeries that allowed him really to live. And so what I want people to gain from watching it in South Dakota is the most important thing is that they need to find their vessel. My dad's vessel was the bike, hence the name of the film. But yours might be walking. It might be rowing a boat. It might be pickleball. It might be ballroom dancing. I don't care what it is, as long as you do one thing and that's you enjoy it. Because if you enjoy it, it's not exercise anymore. And we all have, especially with the pandemic, we've been behind our computers in a crazy amount. You know, this generation of children don't go outside like we used to back in the day. And so I really encourage people to just get out and get active, but do that thing that you love to do, and you'll never work out a day in your life.
Yeah. One of the things, after saying all of that, which I totally agree with and found so inspiring, I just also, as a viewer of a film, was so engaged in every moment of it. And as characters wanted, I mean, I loved how the characters were revealed. I paused at one point and I was like, I don't. It occurred to me that I don't know if you finished the journey or if, you had to quit and, take another run at it next year or if something bad happened to your father on the journey. And so there was a moment where I was like, I don't know how this is going to end. And in a documentary, sometimes that's, that doesn't always get delivered to you in a documentary. So you also made a really good film, Eric.
That's a huge compliment. I really thank you so much. The way you laid that out really means a lot to me. You know, after making the film is no longer yours, is what I've been told, which I love that because now everybody can watch it and get something out of it in their own way. And so, with how busy your life is and the people who are coming out to watch the film, to take the time to watch a piece of work that I put together is my win. That's the ultimate congratulations that I can get that someone wants to sit down and take time to watch a film that I put together. So I really thank you for that.
You can catch upcoming community screenings of Bike Vessel in Rapid City and Spearfish. Learn more at sdpb.ticketbud.com or watch the documentary tonight on SDPB TV. It's on at 9 Central, 8 Mountain. We're going on another bike journey after the break. We will listen in to the Oahe Wheelman from an episode of Dakota Life. And later in the hour, a local pastor who became known as the Pedal Pilgrim because of his book, his blog, and his bike. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB.
Sports and recreation reporting on SDPB is supported by Southeast Technical College. Get your degree, get to work.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. The Bike Vessel documentary explored the significance of a journey. We turn now to a 2023 Dakota Life segment about carving your own trail. Here, the Dakota Life team turned its lens on the Oahe Wheelman from the Pier, Fort Pier area.
Trying to remember when I started getting really serious about riding and what it felt like to then make it a part of who I am and what I do sometimes when circumstances aren't perfect.
There's definitely, obviously, with anything, there's days that you don't wanna. And when you get out there in it, it's so easy to just find yourself smiling.
You don't need to be inspired to do it all the time, but you have to be dedicated to doing it all the time.
Now that I have kids, to show my kids that you don't have to be like, oh, I'm an adult now, I don't do these things. That's why I think cycling's so important too, is just it keeps you going and it gives you a reason to keep moving.
I've never regretted going on a ride. It always feels good once you're done doing it. Sometimes it's the difference in a day as well. Had I slept in, had I skipped that, I may have been lethargic the rest of the day and not that inspired, but if I go out and ride, I'm gonna have a good day. Our club kind of started on a whim, really. Just some friends who had been riding together, and one of them, Dusty Odakovan, said, we ought to call ourselves a club and like make some sweet jerseys. We're like, yeah, that sounds cool. But as it happened, we kind of got interested in doing more about riding in town and thought there should be an active club in town to support riding in any form that you may want to ride a bike.
You know, in a lot of communities, you'll have mountain bike clubs. You'll have road bike clubs, right, or gravel clubs. We realized that that was not going to be effective to get anything done. We needed everybody at the table, and using that combined effort, we could get more done. You know, through the network of small town, got the word out and organized those people, and then that was the creation of the Oahe Wheelman.
Uriah's involvement in the club has been really inspirational. He is enthusiastic and energetic, and he keeps coming up with these fun new ideas for us to do.
The outdoors and recreation obviously comes to mind if you know anything about Pier 4 Pier and the Missouri River, but it's fishing and hunting. And it's really, it's so narrow focused on that scope that like, I feel like people are staring at the river all day fishing, but like the bluffs to me, when I looked up at them, you know, I look at a little hill and I'm like, ooh, you could, you know, do this or that. It's not a huge mountain, but you know, there's fun stuff in there. And actually for mountain biking, it's almost perfect.
The West Shore Trails is one of the proudest accomplishments I think the club has had in its time. It really is hand-built with love, and it's a place that I love to go ride.
That is all hand-built single track. So when we talk about what trail is, really old school. I mean, all built with a tool called a Pulaski, essentially a pickaxe on one side and an axe on the other.
It took us 3 years to do that 5 miles worth of track out there. In fact, we even tried one day with a tiller. We took a tiller out there and thought we might be able to get some accomplishment, and it destroyed the tiller.
The grass that's out there has a root system that's impenetrable and can take 6 to 7 of the hardest whacks you can with a Pulaski just to bust a clod of dirt free. I myself have, you know, well over 500 hours of just hand building trail, of just swinging a Pulaski and a shovel out there.
It also takes a lot of work to maintain those trails, and I will absolutely do the work to maintain the trails so that I get to ride there. I don't balk at the number of times I have to go out there with a brush mower or some big bladed weed eater, because it brings me joy. It really brings me joy and peace to be out there, because it's one of the most beautiful places on earth to me.
Even if you're a little kid, you remember, you know, seeing bikes in the front yard. I know that's not really the calling card anymore, but previous generation might say that was how you found out where everybody was, is where the bikes were.
I don't remember a time when I didn't have a bike. I've seen the pictures of me as a toddler with one of those little trikes with training wheels. I remember the banana seat with the chopper handlebars that I had next. And from there I got a Huffy Bandit, was this new model that came out. And then the Schwinn 10-speed that I got once I got to middle school, junior high age. I've always been riding a bike, and it was a way to get around, it was a way to go see your friends, it was a way to adventure when you were a kid, and that's never left me.
You know, at our core, it's the explorer in all of us. And like, you can go hike for sure and find out about a new place. But what you can hike in an hour, you can triple on a bike. And so if you want to find out, you know, what's around, you get on a bike and you go figure it out. So yeah, adventure's built into the bicycle. You know, that's just part of what it is.
The best bike is the one that you have and that you will ride. And you don't need all the rest of the gadgets and the gizmos. Just jump on the bike and ride.
Having an open mind to things and, you know, just trying new experiences in life. Now, obviously that's adventure through and through, is it's constantly a new experience and you never know what it's gonna be. You know, and that definitely comes with riding your bike. I mean, for sure, because it's the first way. When we talk about kids riding your bike, that was how you explored. Like, that was your freedom.
Some of the funnest rides are ones where you're not going fast or trying to accomplish anything. You just kind of venture around and you see corners of the community you would have never seen before.
Whatever it is that's your motivating factor, whether you want to get healthier or a new hobby, I mean, do it. Just do it. At the end of the day, it's probably the best thing that you can start doing.
Don't let it hang in your garage from here on out. Go around the block with it. Take it for ice cream. Just and ride it, because there's joy to be had there.
You can find this story and more Dakota Life online at sdpb.org. There's another leg of today's cycling show after the break. You're in the moment on listener-supported SDPB. You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. I'm Lori Walsh. We're spending the hour on physical, personal, and spiritual journeys on bicycles. It's all a part of our coverage of Bike Vessel, a new independent lens film coming to SDPB. Let's close the hour now by meeting Brian Herron. He's known as the Pedal Pilgrim for his long-distance spiritual pilgrimages on his bike. He has a blog at pedalpilgrim.com. He currently lives and works in Sioux Falls, but he's traveled the country and the world. His book is called Alone, A 4,000-Mile Search for Belonging. We're bringing you excerpts from our conversation now when he sat down with me in SDPB's Sioux Falls studios. Let's start with his first major journey, launched when he departed his home in the Pacific Northwest on what he would later come to think of as a pilgrimage.
So I put this pilgrimage together without really understanding the concept of pilgrimage. I just knew I needed to go out and rediscover myself after a very difficult period in my life. Yeah. So I developed and put together this route that would reconnect me with all the places I lived and grown up and the towns and the people as a way to rediscover and figure out who I was in a new time. And it was actually after that that I think the language of pilgrimage came to me, because other people would then say, oh, did you hear about the pilgrimage in Spain, the Camino? It's like, oh, no, I hadn't. Yeah. So I began to get introduced to the idea of pilgrimage after I'd put a pilgrimage together, not knowing I was doing a pilgrimage. There were a number of precipitating events, and that particular period, I was suddenly divorced in 2006, after 25 years of marriage, and that really took me by surprise. Yeah. And then my mother-in-law, with whom I was very close, died in 2008. And then my stepmother was having surgery in 2009, and she died just after surgery. And my work was closing a church. So I hit this period where everything that I was doing, you know, I was breathing, sleeping, dreaming, grief. And the reason that I went out had to do with the fact I could tell the church was getting within maybe 6, 9, 12 months of closing. And I had this feeling that when that came to an end, I didn't know where I was going to go. My kids had grown up. I was divorced. And there was a sense in terms of ministry that the world was changing, the church was changing. And did my skills even meet the needs of the church and the world any longer? So I just hit this place where a big wall was facing me.
Yeah.
And I had to find a new self. Like that if I didn't do this, my soul would die.
Mm-hmm.
So part of the way I'm wired is that if I'm not doing something that feels like it's uniquely me, I'm not a person that can just go to a job.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be somehow fully engaged with who I am. And so part of it is I had to do it to rediscover, you know, my passion and the reason for being in the world and how I serve the world. When I went to the church session, the elders, I had told them that I'm going to do this. I need about 10 weeks off. And the question isn't whether I'm going to do it. It's whether you're going to want me back I'm done. But it's like, I'm going to do this. And they were wonderfully supportive. They're like, Brian, do it. You know, we can't wait till you get back and you tell stories and tell us what you learned. And then I also had them, in a sense, on a pilgrimage as well.
Mm-hmm.
I had 10 speakers come. 5 were people in the church and 5 people out of the church who came to do the preaching so they could get to know this world of people who had a spiritual orientation, but not all of them were in the church. So they could begin to understand this new world that was emerging where people who have spiritual lives, but they're not necessarily doing it in organized religion. I set things up so they could also take a pilgrimage too. It really happened early in life. I began riding my bicycle a lot, and part of it was I'd ask for a ride from my mom to go wherever, and she's like, you have a bike? Just take the bike. Like, you know, you've got legs, use the bike. So I just very early started getting around on the bike, and then that turned into longer rides when I was a teenager, and then that turned into 3 years of bicycle racing where I took 3 years from college and raced. And so it's just really in my blood, and it's not only the enjoyment of the bike, but I've also discovered it's sort of like a spiritual discipline. When I'm on the bike, there are times when it's just a deep meditation. There's something about the rhythm of a bike. You know, it's a very consistent rhythm, the way you feel sometimes on the road and the air around you. And yeah, it becomes, you know, like a moving meditation on the bike. So part of it is that I know that I feel most Brian when I'm on the bike. So there just wasn't a question that I would do this on a bike. I've done 4 pilgrimages, 3 major pilgrimages. This one was largely planned in the sense I did have a route that I was you know, trying to reconnect with all the places I had lived, with the exception of Wisconsin because it was just too far to go. I was going through all the places where I was born, where I went to college, where I grew up. Seminary, all these places. So that part was planned. I had a fairly specific route that would be a big loop, you know, starting in Portland, Oregon, and ending in Portland, Oregon, and then 4,100 miles through 8 different states to get there. So that part of it was fairly well planned, even though I sometimes took a slightly different road because of construction or this or that.
Mm-hmm.
And then the open part had to do with how far I went every day. That part was very unplanned. To get up in the morning and you just don't know how strong you're going to feel that day. So, you know, some days you're amazingly strong and you think, oh, I'm going to only go 65 or 70 miles. Like, oh, well, I feel great. I'm doing 90 today, you know. And other days you hit rainstorms and whatnot. It's like, yeah, that's as far as we're going today. And the biggest challenge of that had to do with making sure I would have a place to sleep at night. So the actual allowing myself to go as far as I could go, that part was okay, but I wanted to make sure that I had a place to sleep. And so that was my biggest worry going into it, that, you know, did I have to have something booked ahead? And I really discovered this within 3 or 4 days, that there's always going to be a place. And sometimes it was a campsite, and sometimes it was somebody who I met at dinner and said, stay here tonight, and sometimes a motel. And what I discovered fairly early into it, that I was always going to have a place to sleep at night. And that actually really loosened me up to where I could wake up in the morning and go, you know, today's 40 miles or today's 90 miles. And I mean, I still always had an idea about where I wanted to land. And I would say probably about 80% of the time that's what happened. But every so often, you know, I either went further or shorter. So.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB. We're talking with Brian Herron, the Pedal Pilgrim. His book is called Alone, A 4,000-Mile Search for Belonging.
Definitely had one night that I was just done. And it was sort of funny because I was going into this town called Helper. And in my imagination, I was like, oh, I love the name of Helper. Yeah. Like, this is the place to land for tonight. It'll be a lovely spot, you know.
Yeah.
And I got into this motel that was kind of a cheap rate place, and they gave me even a cheaper rate. Said, hey, we have another room that we can even take another $5 off. So it's $20 a night, which I should have known better.
There's the red flag there, yeah.
Yeah, and there were, like, broken bikes outside and whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
And I got in, and the toilet wasn't working, and the shower wasn't working right, and it was just an awful experience.
Mm-hmm.
I actually had a good night out. There was an art fair that was happening, and that was actually a nice bright spot for the moment. But I woke up the next morning, and I just had a bad feeling,
mm-hmm.
a foreboding kind of feeling. And it's like, I wonder if I'm going to break psychologically. And a really interesting thing happened is that I was probably 10 miles heading toward the kind of Provo area in Utah, and a piece of the framing for my pannier broke. And when it did, it got into the wheel. Pannier is the bag where you carry all your gear. Yeah, it's a bike term. So it meant that I only had three panniers working.
Yeah.
And then I had to redistribute things, which made it awkward for riding because I had a lot of weight on one side. So I had to constantly pull the bike, you know, another direction to keep myself from veering off the road. And I did that for another, I don't know, 50, 60 miles. But what happened when my pannier broke is that foreboding feeling just went away because I finally had something real to deal with.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, I think things were happening in my mind, you know, and I was getting kind of emotionally paralyzed.
Mm.
And then when something real happened, I was like, oh, okay. I still wasn't thinking about this in pilgrimage terms
mm-hmm.
when I started to write. I just wanted to write the experience.
Yeah.
And so I'd gotten through the first write through, and I think maybe in the second write through, I was getting some structure to it, and I started to put titles
mm-hmm.
to the different sections. And I had first studied some of the Joseph Campbell stuff way back in 1989.
Yeah.
So I had some reference to the hero's journey. It was in my mind.
Yeah.
But I still hadn't tied it into what I had done.
Right.
And I looked at the titles that I had put for this book, and I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, there it is. It's like the belly of the well and the call,
yeah.
you know, and the returning home. It's like, it was just classic, you know, hero's journey. And that's
yeah.
one of the things that I discovered about hero's journey is that people don't really do a hero's journey knowing what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
They feel the call and they go out. But it's like this basic human psychological construct that we see in movies, we see
right.
in our religions, we see in novels. It's like it just keeps showing up over and over again. And then I was almost surprised when I looked at the titles to my book.
Yeah.
It's like, well, there it is again. From my experience of this, there's a couple things I'm thinking about. One is that there's, for me, once I had that experience, it sort of whet my appetite
mm-hmm.
For wanting to do it again, because there's some, and I think part of it's an answer to our overly scheduled
mm-hmm.
lives in our society, where you know we're so focused on work and our contribution to society. And I don't think that's all bad. But I don't know if in our society it's very well balanced. And I think, you know, I think of other societies where they have a much slower pace. I don't know if they have the need to take off on pilgrimage.
Sure.
You know, when it's sort of built into their week and into their day, they take time for connecting with each other and enjoying each other and drinking coffee together. For people that have that, there still may be a yearning, but I don't know if it's the same yearning we have, where we really have to just get away from it to have that experience. But I think we're all wired for that. The first question of the Shorter Catechism of the Westminster Confession of Faith, I'm going to get all religious on you here, but the question is, what is the chief end of man or chief end of humanity? And the answer is, the chief end of man or humanity is to glorify God and enjoy God forever. And I think the older I get, the more I can frame my own life and go, you know what, I've spent most of my life on the first half of that, the glorifying, sort of working for God.
Yeah.
And the older I get, the more that there's something beautiful about just sitting and enjoying, being on the front porch with a glass of lemonade and watching life go by and just appreciating the goodness and the beauty of sitting there. I didn't get that when I was younger. And it's the beauty around you. It's also the rhythm of your breathing.
Yeah.
It's the embodiment. And I'll be teaching a 5-week class at the church on life is pilgrimage, but one of those is on embodiment. That part of our spirituality is to be embodied, and to live it out. You know, in the Christian tradition, we call it incarnation. It's the in the flesh part of it. And sometimes we separate out. You know, spirit is good, flesh is bad.
Sure.
And I think we've got it wrong on that one. It has to be embodied. I mean, the first thing that comes to my mind is just thank you. Me now saying it to that guy then, thank you for having the courage to just step out and do it, because I think about this shows up in my journaling, it shows up in my sermons. I refer back to those experiences a lot. This is what I discovered, when I was out on pilgrimage. Like, the lessons that came from that are tremendous. All of the pilgrimages. I learned more and discovered more about myself and the world. Probably more in a 10-week period than I would maybe over a year or two of going to work, taking care of things. Those experiences sort of feed you one experience after another of lessons. And so much of it has to do with you really do put aside all distractions. And you're out there by yourself with yourself. It's like there's no hiding. Like, who's the real Brian? Who's not distracting himself by watching TV or doing this, like, okay, you're going to have to face yourself.
Yeah.
And that sort of scared me at first, and now I love it.
Right. Brian Herron's book is called Alone, A 4,000-Mile Search for Belonging. You can find him online at pedalpilgrim.com. And a reminder, you can catch the upcoming community screenings of the documentary Bike Vessel in Rapid City and Spearfish. Learn more at sdpb.ticketbud.com or watch it tonight on SDPB TV, 9 Central, 8 Mountain Time. And that is our show for today. We hope that it served you. In the Moment is produced by Ari Youngeman and Ellen Kester. I'm Lori Walsh. From all of us here at SDPB, we thank you for listening.